Dr. John Cousins.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, thank you, Mark, for that excellent introduction, and thanks for inviting me to speak. I haven't fully worked out how I'm going to end this talk and how long it will go on for, but it has to go on for approximately an hour, so it probably will. When I get to the end, we'll see. So, but hopefully there'll be some time for questions. I presume that's the procedure. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. So as Mark said, the background context for this talk is an article that I've written for Mark's forthcoming Strange Attractor called "Revolutionary Spirit Wars in Contemporary Haiti: The Case of the Monumental Pig," which is a piece of writing based on a short film I made during the Ghetto Biennale that was organised by Leah Gordon, who's at the front of the room here, and the artists of the Grand Rue, Artiste Resistance in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, the Grand Rue area, in December 2009. And I won't go too much into the details of that, but the idea of the Ghetto Biennale was basically to counter the dominant idea of international biennales where wealthy artists travel to, metropolitan cities and stay in hotels and show their work, etc. And actually to invite international artists to a place they ordinarily wouldn't go, which was a slum in part of Port-au-Prince. And so I was very privileged to be invited to go along to that. While I was at in the Ghetto Biennale, I met some amazing people, many, many amazing people. And two particular people, Cameron Broman and Reginald Jean-Francois. Cameron was working on a project making toy tap-taps with children from City Soleil, slum area, even poorer slum area in Port-au-Prince. And their project was really inspiring for me, so I hung out with them for a while and had a camera and I was filming their project. I told them why I'd gone to Haiti, or the background story. Please come in, and if you want to go through, it'd be easier to be
okay
over there.
Then sorry to interrupt.
No problem at all.
Cheers.
And so I told them basically a kind of background story, which I'll be covering today, why I was in Haiti, which has to do with Georges Bataille and certain coincidences about the Bois Caïman ceremony, which I'll tell you about later, which was the ceremony which in many ways kick-started, at least in legendary terms, the Haitian Revolution in 1791. And that ceremony famously involved the sacrifice of a wild pig to the Haitian Loa, the gods and spirits of Africa. And I told them I was interested in how I'd arrived there by circuitous routes. And Cameron told me that he'd heard this story from Reginald, who'd been living in Haiti for the last 10, 15 years. He's a deportee from Miami. That in 2004, during the ousting of President Aristide, one of the first things the United Nations forces did when they arrived in Haiti was to go to this monument of the Florentine boar. It's actually a replica of a famous sculpture from Florence, the Florentine boar, that has been put in Plaza Italia in downtown Port-au-Prince. I haven't been able to find out historically why it was put there or how it was given to Haiti, but there's a replica of it in the Louvre as well. Anyway, it was there, and when the United Nations peacekeeping forces arrived, the Sri Lankan troops did a symbolic ritual very shortly after arriving, where they, for several hours, did a musical ritual around this pig, defaced it with red paint, bound its ankles, painted crosses on it, and basically did a symbolic ritual binding of this effigy in downtown Port-au-Prince. And these were UN troops in uniform, some in uniform, some in robes with musical instruments. So basically, this is a story of the United Nations peacekeeping forces involved in some kind of religious psychic psyops in 2004. And the film that I made when I was there was Reginald Jean-Francois telling me the story of the trip, this story, as we drove through Port-au-Prince to the ceremonial pig. Then we arrived there, and it was a very straightforward film. Since I made the film, I've been doing some more research about this story. And just to summarise a little bit, it's quite hard to get too much information about this, but what seems to be the facts, as best we can gather them, is that there's a rumour, and there has been a rumour for many years amongst Christian fundamentalists in Haiti, that the Haitian voodooists worship an effigy of the famous pig that was sacrificed for the Bois Caiman ceremony. Now, according to voodooists I've spoken to, this is not true. But Christian fundamentalists believe it. There's a myth going around in Christian fundamentalist circles. So what seems to have happened is whoever is informed by the intelligence of the United Nations peacekeeping forces is informed by Christian fundamentalist intelligence. So they assumed this was the pig that the Haitian voodooists worshipped, and they symbolically bound it to try and tell the Haitian people, hey, you voodooists, we know what you're up to, we know you worship a pig, and we're going to sort it out before you even start. But I haven't had any information back from the United Nations themselves as to why that happened. So that was the film that I made, and I called it Invisible Mirrors. And that's kind of the background story. So since I went to Haiti, I've had a renewed interest in things that I was interested in the past through my research into Georges Bataille, which I'll be talking about today. Now, what I really want to say now is I'm going to try and do two. There's two kind of stories here. The first story I want to tell is not in any way straightforward, but it is the one that I know the best, which is the story of how I came to be interested in Haiti and the Bois Caiman ceremony through reading Georges Bataille. That's one story. I'll tell that story. But there's another story emerging, which is to do with which is an incomplete story, about the ways in which French surrealists in the 1920s and 30s were very interested in revolution, and they were kind of haunted by the terror of the French Revolution, the bloodthirsty terror. There's another story of surrealism's relationship with post-colonial struggles in the 1920s and 30s. And although there's no direct correlation between, there, I haven't been able to find any awareness of surrealists knowing about the Bois Caiman ceremony in the 1920s, certainly by the 1940s, many surrealists were in Haiti, and suddenly there was much more awareness of Haitian history and Haitian voodoo. But it didn't happen until after Bataille had been writing about the role of sacrifice in triggering revolutionary uprisings, which is what led me there. So I'm going to try and bring these two different histories together. So I'll start with how I became interested in Bataille and how it led me to an interest in Haiti. When I began my MA many years ago in art history and theory at the University of Essex, I was supposed to be writing about Antoni Tàpies, the Catalan painter. And Tàpies had an interest in certain kinds of materials, earthy materials, base materials. And I told my tutor at the time, I said, I'm really into this. I can't work out how, it's interesting, how Tàpies thinks that by using, you know, straw and sackcloth and clay, he's somehow communicating the spirit of revolution, which Tàpies also believed. He was a revolutionary artist. I was young, didn't understand it. My tutor said, well, funny enough, I just read this article on materialism in this edition of October magazine about this guy called Georges Bataille, and it's Annette Mitchelson's article on base materialism, so you might want to have a look at that. So I went and read this book, and it completely blew me away. It had nothing to do with Tàpies, nothing to do with abstract painting, and everything to do with eroticism and horror. And it reawoke in me memories of the many nights I'd spent as a teenager watching Hammer horror films on Friday night appointments with fear. And that these films really resonated with what Bataille was talking about, the necessary relationship of sexuality with violence and with death. And it kind of threw me, and I said, that's really amazing. What was all that about? And why would it be possible for me to write an MA thesis on horror in an art school? So I went back to my tutor and I said, look, I really want to write about horror. And these were the kinds of films, it's one of my favourite images from Jimmy Sangster's 1971 Lust for a Vampire, were the kind of image that impressed my young mind as a boy. And resonated strongly with what I found in Georges Bataille. So thankfully my tutor was very sympathetic and said, well, okay, you've got a year to do this. go for it, if you think you can do it. So I ended up writing an MA thesis about the psychology and aesthetics of horror, inspired by Bataille. And one of my kind of concerns then, and it sort of continued through, was this question, which is kind of a naive, childish question, which was, how come we can see images of people being decapitated and blood-smeared breasts and all sorts of image of eroticized violence in horror films, but we can't see pornography? And pornography was much more scandalous in terms of mainstream media, television, than horror. And what is this? Why is that? And that was a question that was really guiding my MA research. And so I was very interested in the way in which horror and the license to represent sexuality within eroticized violence was maybe part of a control mechanism, broader control mechanism. I was reading a lot of William Burroughs at the time as well, so his notion of control was informing my thinking at the time. So I was trying to balance out these ideas. Anyway, I wrote an MA thesis which tried to explore these ideas, very much informed by psychoanalytic theory at the time, mainly because that was the most kind of abundant resource. There was a lot more psychoanalytic theory about the aesthetics and psychology of horror anywhere else, even though Bataille really isn't explicitly associated with that area. So, I did my MA, life went on, I did other things. And a few years later, I went back into education, the Royal College of Arts, for my PhD. And this time I'd realised after 4 years out that there was something still fundamentally problematic about Bataille's theory of eroticism and the revolutionary, an idea there's a revolutionary power to images of extreme transgression and horror. And I was like, how can that be? Because we can see these images in the mainstream media. They don't seem to be stimulating and provoking social transformation revolution. So what's missing here? Because philosophically, I agree. I was in a great deal of agreement with Bataille. So I wrote a PhD thesis called Revolting Subjects, Georges Bataille and Epidemic Disorder, which focused on the video nasty controversy in Britain in the 1990s. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the video nasty controversy, in the mid, 1980s, early 80s, in the mid 80s in Britain, there was a tabloid-driven campaign against a series of very violent horror films, which included combinations of extreme sexuality and extreme violence. And there was a campaign led primarily by Mary Whitehouse, who coined the term video nasty for the tabloid press. And so I was researching this, and I did a lot of case studies of films like I Spit on Your Grave, Cannibal Holocaust, and Last House on the Left, etc. Not particularly pleasant films to spend a lot of time watching, but I had a PhD to complete, so I did. And really what I think the question I was asking was how to reconcile Bataille's theory of the revolutionary power of images of extreme transgression with the theory of media terror as a form of social control and manipulation. This is what I was trying to work out. Where's the liberation in this? Where's the revolution in this? And so that's what my PhD was about. Now, although it's very hard to imagine that these films would kind of cause social revolution, some people did think they were very dangerous, the censors in particular, and the tabloid press. And this kind of reflected a deeper anxiety about the fact that there may be special powers to certain kinds of videos, which I liked. I liked the idea that if you got hold of these dangerous videos and put them in your video player and watched them, something terrible would happen to you. Or, it's like The Ring, And actually, it was great. The more taboo they were, the more power they had. So I could definitely recognize the sense of taboo and power. And at that time, there was, of course, the myth of snuff films, which were the ultimate taboo film. And, it's like the kind of idea that maybe it's a snuff film, and if you watch it, you'll be forever implicated in the horror of that real death. So I was writing and thinking about this for several years. One of the things that came up from that is that although there really isn't any clear evidence to suggest that these kinds of films were likely to cause any major social transformation, there was an ideological association being drawn by the Margaret Thatcher at the time to do with, as Mark said earlier, like patching up the cracks that were beginning to appear in British society in the early 80s. So although there was clearly no direct link between video nasties, and events like the Brixton riots in 1981 and the subsequent riots which took place throughout Britain. In terms of the political culture of Britain in the early 1980s, there was a correlation made that somehow the Tories, Margaret Thatcher in particular, tried to suggest, use the video nasties as a kind of smokescreen. So we'll do something about law and order, we'll ban these videos, and that will stop riots happening in Bristol and Toxteth or wherever else. This correlation was made, not directly, but indirectly through the discourse of politicians in the 1980s. So although there wasn't any direct correlation between video nasties and social unrest and revolution, there were historical coincidences about that. And that's the most I could really come up with in terms of any association between video nasties and social disorder. It was working on the part of either a paranoid delusional or kind of a politically expedient myth generated by conservatives in the 1980s. Okay. However, what was uncovered is a deeper history of anxieties about media influence and diabolical forces somehow coming through cinema screens, television screens, and somehow seducing you into some kind of satanic, demonological engagement with forces beyond your control. And this is a myth, very strong mythic pattern, underpins the snuff myth too. Snuff films almost had to happen. They were a myth long before they were a reality. There was some almost implicit in the logic of media representations of extreme violence, as we now know. I mean, snuff television is widespread and common. Snuff on the internet, widespread and common. It wasn't in the 1980s. So I became interested in what this history was of these fears of mimetic contagion, the copycat effect. That somehow if you watch something, you'll be possessed by it and rush out and do the same things as you've seen in the film. And I started to trace these ideas back to different sets of concerns. I sort of put these the wrong way around. On one side, you have this idea of the hidden persuaders, Vance Packard, late 1950s. But of course, Vance Packard's work on the hidden persuaders, which is about advertising and depth psychology, and the fact that depth psychology in the 1950s was being applied to advertising. This was much older. It actually goes back to Edward Bernays. Those of you who have seen Adam Curtis's The Century of the Self will know this. Edward Bernays was Sigmund Freud's nephew, and he invented public relations, which he called the engineering of consent, and the engineering of democracy. I'll get it right, but it's the same kind of idea. In many ways, what you find, and this may be slightly paranoid, but it's not something that I kind of concluded, is that often the anti-manipulators are a long way behind the manipulators. The people who have the power to manipulate the masses and utilise forces to do so tend to do so a long time before the counter-manipulators unmask their technologies and techniques. And that's historical fact. I mean, well, I propose it. Historical fact. It's a pattern, let's say, that I seem to recognise, that the unmaskers come too late. And usually by the time they start masking, they get accused of being conspiracy theorists. The other idea is, of course, that mass persuasion is from things like, you know, the rise of the Third Reich, the Nuremberg rallies, National Socialism, etc. And what's behind this, and I cherish this idea, this fears of mass-mediated mimetic behaviour and social contagion, through a series of ideas going back into the 19th century. Most significantly is a book called The Crowd by Gustave Le Bon, written in 1895, and one of the first books of crowd psychology. And Hitler had indeed read Gustave Le Bon's book, The Crowd, and utilised it in Mein Kampf, etc. So he was actively applying theories of crowd psychology to modes of political control. These were active applications. How to manipulate the masses, how to construct and generate social movements through the control of the media, control of rhetoric, etc., etc. And he got his ideas from Gustave Le Bon. So I started reading Le Bon. And when you read Le Bon, you get to this very interesting area that the really key figure behind theories of crowd psychology is Anton Mesmer. Before I get there, I want to just say, I realise there's a slight delay. In 1933, Georges Bataille had kind of broken with the formal surrealist movement because André Breton had tried to consolidate the movement into a kind of a new brand of the movement. He felt it was dissipating in 1929. He called for you're either with us or against us. Bataille said, screw you, you're an idealist, I'm out, in 1929. And he formed a new renegade surrealists, dissident surrealists, along with people like Michel Lyris, I'll mention. They aligned themselves with a magazine called La Critique Sociale, which is an extreme left magazine in Paris in the 1930s, edited by a guy called Boris Souverain. In that magazine, Bataille wrote an essay called The Psychological Structure of Fascism, which is one of the first essays to try to come to terms with how fascism works. And in that, he outlined a very, very important theories for Bataille's overall thinking. This is 1933. And that is that what fascism does, and what all social movements do, in fact, all social structures, is you can describe all social forces according to two types of forces. One he called homogeneous, and one he called heterogeneous. It's a very simple polarity. But the homogeneous forces are always in the interest of reason, calculation, order, common sense. They're clear, they're lucid, they're formal. Heterogeneous elements are associated with the sacred. They're irrational, they're violent, they're capricious, and they are chaotic. And this is what he meant by the sacred. And what he felt was happening, you have to read the essay, collected in his collection of works, Visions of Excess. He argues that what fascism was doing was harnessing the powers of the sacred to form a new kind of state. And what he said Marxists were missing at the time was they completely neglected the role of the sacred and religious forces in the construction of social bodies and political groups. And by doing so, they'd missed a trick. And that's why they didn't really understand, Marxism didn't really understand National Socialism. Because it didn't realise how they were utilising occult symbols, mythic powers of the fatherland, etc., etc. All sorts of psychology that was being mobilised in the interests of forming these massive collectives. So it's a very interesting work. The point being that heterogeneous forces, which Bataille believes the homogeneous order utilises in times of crisis, are basically, they constitute the sacred. And the sacred has two poles, the left and the right. And in very simple terms, traditionally, the sacred was always something that was set apart because it was taboo and prohibited. And it had an incredible powerful force. Now, those forces are both attractive and repellent. And the important point for Bataille is that archaic notions of the sacred had both these dynamics associated with them. Bataille famously said, every object of attraction can become an object of repulsion and vice versa. And what he felt was going on in social sciences was what was being neglected was the repellent forces, the forces of the abject sacred, the left-handed sacred, the base, material, excremental forces of the sacred, which you can use to create certain kinds of structure. So if you create a scapegoat like the Jews and say that the Jews are vermin, like rats, like the film The Wandering Jew famously did, and describe Jewish people as rats coming in from the Middle East and invading territories, etc., you can use abject representations of the dark sacred to construct psychologies which will help you build your social structures. So these kinds of powers have been mobilised by the Third Reich and they needed to be understood. Anyway, so I was interested in this magnetic metaphor, this attraction and repulsion. Bataille wrote two essays on attraction and repulsion when he was participating in the College of Sociology, which had been gathered together by Denis Ollier too. So what is the role of the sacred, these attractive forces, these repulsive forces? And I trace this magnetic metaphor of the dynamic processes by which social formations occur around the sacred to, one way through this, I should mention, is through Durkheimian sociology, which Bataille was familiar with. Durkheim, in The Elementary Forms of Religious Life, had said a similar thing about attraction and repulsion and different kinds of prohibitions. That was where the force of social cohesion comes from. We are drawn together by that which we're attracted to. We're also drawn together by that which we are repulsed by. So the creation of the abject other is a means by which clean, pure bodies of social beings can come together. So this role of the sacred had been seriously neglected, and Bataille was exploring it. The important thing too is that although Bataille is talking about the sacred, he's a materialist. Very important, he's not an idealist. He's not an ideologue. He's saying these forces exist in all human societies. In fact, what characterises human societies is the existence of prohibitions and taboos. There are things which we say are repulsive, abject, we must stay away from. There are things which we put up on pedestals, say we must worship and adore. The ideal sacred and the abject sacred. And these are dynamic realities that shape social structures, whether we like it or not. As humans, we can't deny it. And in many ways, I always throw the Baphomet in, because in many ways there's a kind of occultist tradition also informing this about the left-handed path of the sacred and the right-handed path, you know, the idea that, you know, so above, so below. And also there's a strong tradition within ethnography that the left-handed is associated with the sinister, with the excremental, with the contaminated, and the right hand stays pure, so you can eat with the right hand. It's also the right hand of God that Jesus is resurrected onto. There's all sorts of dynamic polarities within the history of religions which operate around this kind of schemata. Okay, so this led me to Antoine Mesmer. Antoine Mesmer was a German physician who developed a technique called animal magnetism at the end of the 18th century. Basically, this is a transition from a demonological or a religious interpretation of psychological illnesses according to possession or demons or supernatural forces to a purely materialist or physicalist interpretation of disease and disorder. Mesmer said there's a universal fluid called ether that permeates all bodies, and that when it's out of balance, it causes illness and various kinds of disorders. So he found a technique for manipulating these energies, called it animal magnetism, and he would manipulate these electromagnetic energies and cure people of all sorts of diseases. He also used an iron rod, which he would operate as a kind of wand, which would be magnetized, and he would run it over bodies, and people would be miraculously cured. He would say, we don't need any religious explanation for this, it's purely material. He was influenced by Newton, etc. Very much an Enlightenment idea. Now, in Paris, and this is the hinge here, in Paris, of the late 18th century, pre-revolutionary Paris, many of the proto-revolutionary leaders joined what Mesmer called societies of harmony. You went there, you attached yourself to a baquet, these metal rods and wooden constructions, and you would be cured, and you go into a kind of crisis, convulsions, and you would be cured. Hugely popular, and it spread throughout Paris, and the authorities got wind of it and wanted to kind of suppress it, which they eventually did. Now, what was weird when I was doing this research about the history of mesmerism and fears of the mass master, the crowd master, because it's Mesmer who is the prototype for people like Hitler, through someone like Le Bon. These are people who are able to exercise influence over the masses, charismatic influence. Mesmer didn't talk about charisma, but Le Bon did. And certain people were vulnerable to suggestion. Le Bon famously said, women, children, and savages were more vulnerable to suggestion than, of course, mature, enlightened Western men who would never fall prey to such forces. But this gives you the tone of the kind of thinking at the time. So they see Mesmer as actually the prototype of a kind of magician, a social magician, who is able to harness unseen forces, energies, and use them to manipulate crowds and manipulate masses. Now, as I was doing this research, I found this strange quote that Mesmer claimed responsibility for the foundation of the Republic of Haiti, because he claims people were practicing mesmerism in Haiti in the 18th century, and the slaves mistook it for voodoo, and it led to a social uprising. Now, this sounded to me like a very far-fetched claim, and I looked into it, what I discovered was, in fact, there was a ceremony I'll come back to this, which is a representation on the left here, in which a ritual sacrifice took place, the Bois Caiman ceremony, that did allegedly give rise to the Haitian Revolution. However, that's not mesmerism, that's something else. And this is what took me to Haiti, this exploration of what's this correlation. I'm using the image on the right here as well, because in the 1930s, Bataille was so convinced that you could trigger a revolution through ritual sacrifice, that he formed a group, a cult called Assefal, along with various other people. On the surface, it was dedicated to a religious interpretation of the works of Friedrich Nietzsche. But secretly, they were having gatherings in woods near Paris around a tree that had been struck by lightning. And they were planning a ritual human sacrifice in about 1936, which they believed would trigger the revolutionary forces necessary to counter the imminent invasion by Nazi Germany. That was the theory behind these ritual meetings that were taking place in the secret society. Jacques Lacan, a famous psychoanalyst, was also attending at these rituals around the tree in 1936, just as a bit of gossip. Lacan actually married Bataille's wife, and Bataille's girlfriend at the time, Laura Colette Peignot, was... Anyway, there's a lot of interrelationship stuff going on at the time. So they were meeting in 36 around this tree, doing ritual ceremonies, trying to trigger a revolution. So there's this incredible correlation between the idea of a ritual sacrifice triggering social revolution and the realities of the Haitian Revolution, which seemed quite far-fetched in terms of Mesmer's claim. In terms of Bataille, is the only revolutionary moment that made sense according to his theories. Now, what's really weird about this, I'll go back. This is stuff I've been finding out recently, is that although it seems very far-fetched, mesmerism did in fact arrive in Haiti. It was brought there by someone called a Puisiger, Count de Puisiger, a member of the Puisiger family. One of the Puisigers was very famous. He'd invented this thing called somnambulism, or automatic sleep, which is the idea that you put somebody into a trance. When they're in a trance, you can control their will, the somnambulist. This was the Marquis de Puisiger invented this. People in a trance could predict the outcome of their own cures. So they would do internal diagnostics. They would see their own inner organs and say, actually, I've got something wrong with my liver or my spleen or my heart, in trances. Now, Mesmer was very... This sounds like occultism. It sounds like mysticism to me. Don't like it. But Puisiger pushed this, and Puisiger's brother brought mesmerism to Haiti. Now, when mesmerism arrived in Haiti, it spread very quickly through the plantation owners. Now, this is the bit that was really kind of trips me out, is that there's been this kind of correlation between somnambulists and zombies in popular media for a long time. On the one hand, the somnambulist is controlled by the mesmerizer, who walks around in his sleep, in the case of the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And they go around doing evil things because they're under control by somebody else. The zombie figure is similarly a kind of somnambulist. It's a living dead. It is controlled by a bokor, a malefactor, who is able to go and do things as if asleep and do the evil bidding of this control. Now, that just seemed, maybe that it seemed like that was a coincidence, and something that, in fact, maybe Hollywood had constructed with films like White Zombie, the first Hollywood zombie film, and later I Walked with a Zombie by Jacques Tournier in 1943. But the weird thing is, the records show that when mesmerism arrived in Haiti, the first thing the slave owners used it for, apart from curing their friends and family, was on their slaves. And they used it to get extra work out of their slaves. So if you had a depleted slave stock, you could use mesmerism to re-energize them. So slave masters were using mesmerism to re-energize slaves shortly before the Haitian Revolution. Of course, this doesn't in any way suggest that Mesmer's claim is true, except for mesmerism spread through Haiti. It was okay once it stayed with the white plantation owners and they were using it to regenerate their slaves. However, once it fell into the hands of the black slaves, they acted quickly to suppress it. And it did. And it fell into the hands of the black slaves at a place called Marmalade, which is very close, but not close enough, to Bois Caiman, the alligator woods, where the Haitian Revolution started. 10 years earlier, mesmerists were practicing in the Marmalade. Two slaves, Jerome and Telemaque, began to mix mesmerism with a form of early voodoo called Petro. And they used the symbolism of the cross machetes, they used rituals which were known to be Petro rituals, and mixed it with Haitian voodoo. So although that wasn't the Bois Caiman ceremony, there was a genuine meeting of mesmeric animal magnetic practices with Petro voodoo in Haiti in around 1785, 86. Which is, so mesmer's only a few years out and is close to the truth. So anyway, that's how I ended up in Haiti through Bataille and his theory of sacrificial revolution. And I've only got a few minutes left, so I want to just take another trajectory if I can. What I'm trying to, hopefully it's kind of doing this a bit, because weird stuff happens around this idea of mass manipulation. I'm hoping that the images say a lot in terms of this question of control. The important thing about, by the time White Zombie and I Walked with a Zombie are being distributed, this is the time of the anti-superstition campaigns in Haiti, when voodoo was being suppressed, firstly during the American occupation, and secondly after the American occupation, by presidents of Haiti who were deeply anti-voodoo. They tried to eradicate voodoo from the island. These films are made at the same time. But in terms of a kind of Western discourse of telemediated contagion, the cinema had already been set up as a somnambulistic space, going right back to the magic lantern shows, darkened rooms, projected light, people in a trance, being hypnotised by these lights, and there was a very hypnotic understanding of cinema. And from its history on, from the magic lantern shows onwards, there was this anxiety about how cinema was a form of mass hypnosis. It's very familiar. Even people like F.R. Leavis were talking about this in the 1930s. It was very common. So this goes right through the history of cinema. What I'm saying is there's a mesmeric, somnambulistic dimension to cinema from its inception that strangely coincides with the discourse of the zombie in Haiti. I've written about this elsewhere. Okay. I'm not going in the right direction. Okay. So there's this strange correlation. The point is that, as far as I know, Bataille wasn't thinking about Haiti at all. And I don't think he knew about the Haitian Revolution, or wasn't consciously talking about the Haitian Revolution. Post-colonial struggles weren't paramount in the 1920s, but they did start to become much more paramount among surrealists in France during the 1930s. The interesting thing is, as well, that there's this kind of legacy of primitivism in French culture anyway. Since Picasso and the Trocadero and the Musée de l'Homme, Josephine Baker, there was a kind of fascination with black culture. Michel Leiris was a big jazz fan in the 1930s, etc., etc. So there's another trajectory that leads indirectly back to Haiti, and I want to just talk a little bit about that. This is Mike Michel Serrier's book. It's brilliant, highly recommended. What a bargain, £10, can't go wrong. The image on the right, which I was slightly nervous about being used, is an image that Bataille uses towards the end of one of the last books he wrote called The Tears of Eros, which is basically a picture book about erotic art. Now, you might not ordinarily think of this as an erotic picture, but for Bataille, any kind of ecstatic frenzy which involved close communication with death was erotic. Now what's interesting about these images is they're very sensationalist, and they come at the end of Bataille's book. There's no contextualization, very little or no contextualization. He uses them to talk about rather obtuse philosophical reflections about the impossibility of having complete knowledge when all you can really know is the immediacy of the moment. I say obtuse not in a critical way. I mean, it's Bataille's philosophy. It's all about the impossibility and the desire for complete and total knowledge that can only be experienced in a moment of loss in the immediate present, which is what the moment of sacrifice is all about. So this is from 1962 book, but they're actually taken from Alfred Metreau. And this is the route back, the strange route back to Haiti. Alfred Metreau's book, Voodoo in Haiti. Now, it's strange because Bataille's book was written in 62. Alfred Metreau wrote this book in, I think, 1958. Alfred Metreau was one of Bataille's best friends. And they'd met at the École de Chartres in Paris in 1924, shortly before Bataille went off to Madrid and saw Granero get his eye poked out, the bullfighter, famously, in the story of the eye, he saw a bullfight. Bataille was a Catholic at the time. And what you've got to understand about Bataille's religiosity is that he was a very pious Catholic. He converted to Catholicism at about 14, after they'd abandoned his father, who was a paralytic, syphilitic, blind man, to the German invasion of his hometown in 1914. During that time, his mother became manic, tried to hang herself and was suicidal. Not a rough time, but I said, I'm going to convert to Catholicism. It's the only redemption for me. But he was always preoccupied with the more extreme ends of Catholicism, the sacrificial ends of Catholicism. So anyway, Metreau was his friend. Metreau ended up writing this book called Voodoo in Haiti, one of the first major texts. But again, Metreau didn't go to Haiti until 1941. And when he got there, there was already an anti-superstition campaign taking place. And there were piles of voodoo artifacts and voodoo drums waiting to be burnt in an auto-da-fé outside Port-au-Prince. And actually, Metreau wrote this book because he believed that Haiti was going to, I mean, voodoo was going to be extinct, and that it needed to be recorded before it was died, it was exterminated completely. Thankfully, that isn't what happened, but that's why Metreau wrote this book. Now, I realise I'm moving on. So there's one thing, this is the incomplete closure. As I said, now moving in a more formal way back to Haiti, this link between Bataille, voodoo and Haiti. And I've got, this may sound strange, but I want to say this, because it's one of those things that I did want to get in. Now, when Bataille and Metreau in the École de Chartres, they apparently looked really, really similar. They'd often be mistaken for each other. They also had a taste in women, and it goes like this. They shared a taste for women in black silk pyjamas with long gold cigarette holders and boyish haircuts, moving around in poorly defined and rather ambiguous surroundings. So Bataille wasn't as pious as all that. And, you know, they notoriously spent a lot of time in brothels in the 1920s and 30s. In fact, in about 1927, shortly before the Surrealist movement started, Leiris, Bataille's other close friend, and him were going to set their own movement up called Yes, and it would be based in a brothel in Rue Saint-Denis. It would be their version of the Surrealist movement. And anyway, you'll see why that's maybe relevant as we come towards closure. Okay, Metreau there's too much historical detail there, I won't go too much into it, but Metreau introduced Bataille to Marcel Mauss's essay on the gift, for which Bataille developed his theory of sacrifice. He didn't always have this theory of sacrifice and the importance of sacrifice in the general economy, the giving without return. He got that from Alfred Metreau. And Metreau was constantly in touch with Bataille, and as we saw, the images that Bataille used from the voodoo ceremony were Metreau's photographs that he used in voodoo in Haiti. Importantly, though, I think the purpose of Metreau's book was to banish the sensationalist negative image of voodoo. He said that he wanted to dispel the sensationalist picture of voodoo as a dark Saturnalia celebrated by blood-maddened and sex-maddened Negroes. In some ways, that's the bit that Bataille kind of liked as well. So there were very different kinds of personalities. Metreau himself was initiated into voodoo in order to complete his study in 1944. The other key figure here is Michel Leiris, who met Bataille in 1924. Michel Leiris, shortly after Leiris joined the Surrealist movement, Bataille reluctantly joined. A year later, Breton was trying to take over, telling everybody who they could have sex with, what drugs they could take, what things they could and couldn't do, and people who weren't having it, and they decided not to be officially Surrealist. Leiris was one of the dissidents too. They left and they started writing a magazine called Document, very famously dissident Surrealist ethnography magazine. And shortly after that, Michelaris went on a mission to Africa, set up by Marcel Griot, called the Dakar Djibouti Mission. Now, this is just another bit of a slight detour, which I think some of you may be interested in. It was on the Dakar Djibouti Mission to cross Africa that Marcel Griot first encountered the Dogon people of Mali. And I don't, for those of you who read Stranger Traps, you may be familiar with the Dogon, who have a myth of the Nomo people, who are amphibious, hermaphrodite, fish-like extraterrestrials that the Dogon had mythology of, who had arrived from the planet Sirius in special extraterrestrial vehicles, and they would return again. Nobody knew that Sirius existed at this time, before the Dogon people already had this myth. And so this is quite a big mystery. Anyway, Griot came back, Lyris came back with Griot, and he wrote a book called Phantom Africa. Now, I won't go too much into this, but the importance of Phantom Africa is that it wasn't standard ethnography. What Lyris did was to write about his own unconscious stream of consciousness, phantasmatic investments with Africa. What he's basically saying is this myth of ethnographic objectivity is really impossible now. And actually what I'm going to write about is as much what I feel, how I respond, my fears, my nightmares while I'm in Africa, as the ethnographic observations that I make while I'm there. Now, so he writes that on return to France. And Lyris and Bataille were colleagues all the way through. He also wrote about possession, and Lyris witnessed ritual animal sacrifice in Africa and told Bataille about it. And Bataille says that although Bataille never saw an actual sacrifice, his experience of it was secondhand through both Michel Lyris and somebody else I haven't mentioned, which was his psychoanalyst, Adrien Borel, who, I don't know if a psychoanalyst would do this now, but when Bataille was during his analysis in 1927, Adrien Borel gave him an image of the death by 100 cuts. I haven't shown it today, but it's very famously an image which had a profound impact on Bataille. It's a Chinese torture victim being slowly cut apart, having their limbs torn off one by one, that attempted to assassinate the emperor. And Bataille's psychoanalyst had been present at the execution in 1905 and had brought the photographs back and gave them to his analysand while he was doing analysis. And it helped him finish off the story of the eye, his famous erotic novel that he wrote as a to conclude his 1 year of psychoanalytic work with Adrien Borel. Bit of a sideline, but it's just that Bataille wasn't seeing actual human sacrifice, and in fact, Bataille always wished he could travel to exotic countries and see different things, but he never actually did it. And I haven't got my quote. That's worrying. It's a really good quote. I'll try and find it before the end. Nearly there. Okay. Finally, I just want to sort of end up with this moment, which is just quickly a route back to Haiti through ethnographic surrealism and surrealism's engagement with the post-colonial struggles. I recently came across this amazing anthology put together by Nancy Cunard, the heiress of the Cunard shipping dynasty. And it's an incredible anthology of writings by both black and white writers about the so-called Negro question in the 1930s, published in 1934. It's a huge volume. She set up her own printing press in Normandy, the Hours Press, and sort of self-published this work. Most of the translations are by Beckett. She was the first to publish Beckett. And all the translations from French are by Samuel Beckett of the Surrealists. And the text which really fascinated me in terms of trying to bring this around to a more contemporary situation is this essay from 1931, or this polemical piece called Murderous Humanitarianism, written by the Surrealist group in 1931. And although I haven't got time to extrapolate on this now, there's a history which Michael Richardson has written extensively about in his book Refused of the Shadow, which is this other engagement with Haiti, which comes through the writings of Aimé Césaire, black surrealists, the writings of Frantz Fanon, that is a post-colonial revolutionary surrealism. that suddenly engages once again with Haiti. In 1945, André Breton is on his way back from exile in New York. He goes and gives lectures in Haiti. And a year afterwards, the people who have listened to his lectures have gone on to have a small revolution. It's been called the Haiti's 1968. Leah, you probably know more about this. But so it's an interesting direct correlation between the revolutionary politics of surrealism in the 1930s, post-colonial struggles, and the real politics of Haiti shortly afterwards in the post-war period. And I think that what fascinates me about this murderous humanitarianism, and I'll end here, is that after the earthquake in Haiti, it was seemed very clear to me that there was a militarization of aid which was entirely unnecessary, which was in fact a form of colonialism, and to some extent still is. And when I gave a talk in May, I'm going to end it, this is very simple. I prepared a talk in May, and I had a thing I wanted to say at the end, and I got to the end of the talk, and I didn't say it, because I forgot. And what it is, was that, following Bataille, is that the militarization of aid is a form of religious violence. And that's where I'm going to end it. That's it. Thank you. Well done.